Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of Family Business Today, where every family business has a story to tell and a step to take to not only thrive, but working together, create a lasting family legacy. I'm your host, Greg Lewis. Our guest today is Dr. Diane Welsh, a Hayes Distinguished Professor of Entrepreneurship at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Dr. Welsh is a well-known scholar in entrepreneurship, family business, and franchising. He is past president of the Small Business Institute, past division chair for the Technology and Innovation Management Division of the Academy of Management, and past president and Justin G. Longnecker Fellow of the United States Association for Small Business and Entrepreneurship. Dr. Welsh presented the keynote address on women in entrepreneurship at the United Nations. She is also the architect of the University of North Carolina at Greensboro's Entrepreneurship Program and founder of both the Southern Entrepreneurship in the Arts Conferences in Tampa, Florida, and Greensboro, North Carolina. Dr. Welsh has published 130 journal articles and 8 books, including the go-to book for cross-campus entrepreneurship programs, Creative Cross-Disciplinary Entrepreneurship. Well, good afternoon, Dr. Welsh.
Good afternoon, Greg.
Well, I'm really glad that you could join me for this edition of Family Business Today. I've really been looking forward to learning more about your family business and entrepreneurship expertise.
Well, I'm excited to be on your show. Thanks for inviting me.
Yeah. Well, let's get started. So you have a new book out called Entrepreneurial Family Business From Survival to Success, which talks about your personal experiences in your family business, the Boyd Division of Welsh Sporting Goods. Tell us about growing up in a family business and what influenced your thoughts on the cross-sector of entrepreneurship and family business.
Well, I started in my family business when I was 8 years old, sweeping floors for a dollar a day. You know how that goes.
Sounds familiar.
Yeah, and worked pretty much at every job at the family business. It was a manufacturing plant, and my mother said, never do anything with your hands, always do it with your mouth, Diane. So that's why I'm a professor. But she didn't let me around the sewing machines. But what I realized through that experience is all family businesses need to be entrepreneurial. And they have to survive. And I did an article a few years back, and it was with family offices. And what we found is that if the success of generations weren't entrepreneurial, the family business basically in the family office wouldn't survive. So they have to be entrepreneurial through generations. That's very important.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, thanks for sharing that. But looking at it a little bit different, tell us a little bit about how your family business sort of influenced your thoughts on the overlap between family, business, and ownership. I know we say that family is family and business is business, and never the two shall meet unless, of course, you work together in a family business.
Well, that's really interesting. And I like the view that it's sort of three overlapping circles, and how mm-hmm. much overlapping depends on how much the ownership is, how much the family is, and how much the business is and the management. But my family business, if I can explain that a little bit, my father created soft-sided luggage for the world, which is what most of us use now, and all the backpacks are made out mm-hmm. of. And that was in the early 60s. And back in those days, if you remember your grandparents or great-grandparents, they had Samsonite or an American Tourister that
right.
was basically an aluminum shell with vinyl padding over it. And it sort right. of open if it was on easily, if you couldn't sort of add more in it because it'd pop open. And it was heavy and bulky. And my father and my uncle had bought a company out of bankruptcy, the Boyd Company, that sort of got too big too fast in the early 60s. And it had been the horse business since 1901. Matter of fact, it was the first small manufacturing company west of the Mississippi River. And they were immigrants from England. And they did saddles and harnesses and all kinds of horse equipment. And that sort of evolved over the years to animal equipment. And then they also did deer bags and those kind of things for camping and fishing. And they were one of the biggest suppliers during World War II. They have a bunch of quality awards from the federal government of producing so much quality for the military. So they were a big military supplier both in World War I and World War II. But my dad looked at the gear bag and said, you know, we could make square luggage out of this. And so basically, he drew it on a piece of paper in the office. I remember when he did it and showed it to Bob Crosser, the production manager, and said, you know, those gear bags we make, let's try to make it this shape. And it was just the shape of a basic square luggage bag. And then they tried it out, and my mother's dyed the first samples in the basement, and soft-sided luggage was born for the world. And that's the true story of how soft-sided luggage started. And then from there, they made different shapes and sizes and colors. And
Sure.
my mother was very involved in the business too. She created a very popular denim bag with red trim back in the 70s that was the number two seller. And so my mother sold, and my father was president of Hoyt Division Welsh Sporting Goods. So that's the story. So it sort of evolved out of a sporting goods line, and they kept the sporting goods line. They sort of changed it, you know, to innovate with the time. So they got away from the horse equipment and more into the sporting goods side of things. And that was sort of the basics of the business. That sort of was the foundation to build the luggage business on. So
I
my
see.
dad and mom really created soft-sided luggage for the world, and they couldn't patent the process because it wasn't unique. So that otherwise I probably wouldn't be a professor right now.
Sure. Yeah, we
So that's you know, so the process wasn't unique. They couldn't patent it, but they really created it, and they were big believers in quality. So it was number one in quality. And for about, oh, probably 20 some years growing, the National Luggage Association would do a survey, and they'd ask back in the day in the 60s and 70s, they would ask, even in the early 80s, luggage was sold through luggage stores, not on the internet. And they would
Right.
ask people that were salespeople in the stores, they wouldn't say, what's your favorite or what do you like best? They would say, what is the luggage you carry? And the number one answer was Boyd luggage, because it was very high in quality and very high in durability. And they had a lifetime guarantee on the luggage. You sent it back, and they would fix whatever it was and send it back to you for free. No company in the luggage industry does that today.
Oh, that's great. That's great. Well, thanks for sharing that. Yeah, luggage has changed so much over the years. I know my favorite addition to luggage baggage is wheels, but that's another story. So we'll talk about that. Well, you're a professor of entrepreneurship at the University of North Carolina, Greensboro. Tell us a little bit about how does learning about entrepreneurship differ from learning about business?
So, how is it different? Well, it's very different. Most people think it's the same thing, but it's not, because we focus in entrepreneurship on basically, I can give you the definition. To be an entrepreneur is to be creative and innovative in all you do that creates value. And so, business is functional, it has the accounting function and the marketing function. And, you know, it's sort of the bigger sphere, but entrepreneurship is re really about being creative and innovative in anything that creates value. So you can be an entrepreneur with art, you can be an entrepreneur with science, and actually all of those disciplines and all those fields need to be entrepreneurial. And to be creative and innovative, you need to keep being entrepreneurial. And one of the biggest problems we have is we don't teach people how to be an entrepreneur. We just teach them how to be an artist or how to be a writer, but they have to sell it and they have to be creative and innovative in everything they're doing and get the word out. And so it's all about that aspect of it. So being an entrepreneur is always trying to stay one step ahead of where everybody else is when they're thinking.
So tell us about investing in entrepreneurship. What's the most common mistake that a family business makes in terms of investing in entrepreneurship?
Well, they need to teach and model being entrepreneurial to the next generation. Oftentimes what we see is that the next generation is afraid of doing anything. Past is very conservative investments because they're going to lose grandma, grandpa's or mom and dad's business. And so they have a tendency, those next generations, to be extremely conservative in what they're doing. But what we know is every generation has to be entrepreneurial to survive and be successful. So one of the main things I really bring home is model entrepreneurship, teach entrepreneurship. And oftentimes the best way we have to learn is modeling. And so starting your family members off at an early age, if you want to be involved in the business, is very, very important. I want to say, like, you know, 7 years on, old on, it's amazing what young people can pick up and you don't even realize that. So that's very, very important. And, you know, to always look for that next idea, you know, and now even, you know, right now, there's a lot of really good businesses for sale that you can merge with or, you know, buy a competitor out and really grow the business that way also. So don't hesitate to look at that, because after World War II and the Korean War, and there was a lot of people that came home and started businesses actually all over the world, not just here. And so there's a lot of businesses for sale now that, you know, are good, solid businesses with a good balance sheet with customers already set up. And so sometimes people don't look at that as an aspect of how to grow their business. And it's really an important one. It's something that you don't want to overlook. You got to be careful and really look at those financials, though, because lots of times if owners have done pretty well, they'll pay themselves a dollar a year. And obviously, when most people get in a business, they're not going to be able to do that. So, you know, you got to really pay attention to the financials.
Sure. Yeah, I was thinking about that. My father was from that generation of World War II and the Korean War. And when he came out, he started his company. But he started it out of a need to have a job. Not so much necessary of him being entrepreneurial, but he needed a check to support his wife and maybe son and daughter, who one of those was me. So I understand that. Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that.
No, know? Absolutely
nothing
not
wrong with that at all. But I think a lot of the young people nowadays, they overlook the opportunity for existing businesses. And that's why we need, sometimes sons and daughters don't want to go into the family business and they think it's unexciting, or they just heard too much around the kitchen table about all the problems with the business instead of the good parts. And once in a while I get a parent that says, you got to get my, you know, and son or daughter to take over this business, and I'm leaving it up to you to do that. And I, you know, I always start talking to the student. They're like, yeah, I heard all these bad things my whole life. I don't want to go into that and have to deal with it. And so we got to be very careful on the home front about bringing that business back in the home and only hearing about, you know, how are we going to solve this problem? What's wrong with it? Instead of some of the positives or just changing the conversation. I know that's especially an issue when you have more than one family member working in the business. No, so I think you have to be really careful of that. I often tell family members, I'm a family firm institute, counselor, family business registered counselor. And I often tell them, you know, you don't even realize you're bringing all these things up. You know, you're just trying to get things solved. And meanwhile, the children are hearing that from a very young age. And
sure.
How they interpret that depends on how they're going to look at that as a possible career path.
Sure. Yeah, well, talking about business around the dinner table at home is a entire subject to yourself, and was something that my wife and I worked on real hard over the years, raising three daughters. So we can talk about that another time here. Well, look, so you have an example of an entrepreneurship failure in a family business that you would be willing to share with our listeners?
Well, I can, yeah, I sure can, Greg. I can point right to our family business, actually.
Okay.
Because my father worked there 17 years and had the building paid off. It was a four-story brick building, and it was in the middle of Iowa in a town called Iowa Falls, Iowa. And originally, I think at one point it was a chicken processing plant. And before that, it was where before this, the days of electricity, it used to be make those great big ice cubes, blocks.
Blocks of ice, an ice plant. Uh-huh.
Yeah, it was an ice plant before that. So it was an older building, but it was all paid off. It was a huge building. It was four stories high, and that was paid off. And there was plenty of money in the bank, and there was a very solid business. And it's really important that next generation listens and learns from the predecessors. And that goes back to getting them around the business at an early age. But my cousin was older than us, our side of the family. And my uncle decided he should take over the business. Well, he didn't want to move to a small town in Iowa. He wanted to stay in the big city. And he just didn't listen. So there wasn't that learning going on. And
sure.
Unfortunately, due to that, he had to do with wheels on luggage, actually. Right? Oh, it's funny you brought that up, because
okay.
My dad always said, don't borrow money from New York investors because they're not going to care about anybody's job in the middle of Iowa. So I borrow local. And that's a pretty good saying for any family business. And number two is produce it in Iowa, because quality is utmost important to those people. It's sort of in their veins, you know, and they're small town people, and, you know, never go shirk on quality, never go away from it, and produce your products in Iowa. Well, he started manufacturing the wheels in the Philippines and did it on the cheap, instead of keeping the quality high. And the next thing you know, there were all these customers sending back their luggage, and they bought Voight because they paid more for it because they had higher quality, but it lasted forever, and all these wheels started breaking. So it hurt the brand, and it also hurt the bottom line, because there was that money back. There was 100% guarantee. They sent the bag back.
Sure.
All those wheels had to be fixed, replaced, and then we had to mail the bag back. And even to this day, I could name some luggage brands, but you have to pay your own postage back and forth. And what happened with that is he started borrowing money from the New York investors. And
sure.
Pretty soon the New York investors owned the business and the family didn't. So
okay.
That's the story, unfortunately, what happened. And
sure.
It was about 10 years after my dad had passed away, thank God, and turned over the business. So,
sure.
And we pulled our money out of it because he told my uncle that, you know, he was afraid his son would lose the business and wasn't listening. And he didn't want to hear that. So Dad said, well, you're not listening. And so therefore we're pulling our part of the money out of the business. So anyway, that's the story. It's really, really important to have the right successor, have, you know, groom that successor over the years. And it's not like somebody retires and puts somebody else in, because
sure.
That doesn't usually happen, right?
So
you go back to the wheels again. You said at the earlier part of the show.
That's right. That's right. So, you know, for every failure, there's always two or three successes. So let's not end on a low note. Tell us about an entrepreneurship success story.
Well, one just local is we're here in the middle of North Carolina, and I got a call one day from a couple that said that they had a piece of family property that had been, it had been different things over the years, but basically it had been working with metals and those kind of things.
Uh-huh.
And so making, you know, small pieces of product, I guess bolts and things like that at one point. And they had wanted to do something with the property, and it was in sort of pretty bad shape. And it had some issues with asbestos, and they had to do all the, you know, environmental cleanup of the building and stuff. But the family also owned, probably four or five little houses around this manufacturing facility. It wasn't really big. It was sort of, and it had been there a long time. I think it's a over 100-year-old building. And they said, you know what we want to do? We want to open a microbrewery. And I said, well, great. And so they had me come over. And I'm like, oh, you know, you didn't want to say you were shocked, but it was in pretty bad shape. But it has some really cute little things, you know. The office, they had the original office that was in the family, and you know, a lot of the keepsakes and stuff on the wall. Well, sure enough, they got the building cleaned up, and they said, can we get a student team to help us with a business plan? So I said, great. And so we put a student team on it, five students with all different backgrounds, marketing, you know, entrepreneurship, all different backgrounds. I always like to put in accounting, finance, and student. We did
uh-huh.
all the spreadsheets. They were really good about giving us all the information on the costs and everything. And of course, the building was paid for. It was in the family. So that helped, because the cleanup was quite expensive. And we actually made the drawings for the logo, for the name of the business, for the drawings for, you know, the pictures of the building, everything for advertisements, and did a feasibility plan, which is idea to opportunity. Is it really a good idea, or is it really an opportunity? We all know that not all ideas are opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Might be a fun idea, or they might be a good idea, and there might be our idea, but not all of them are opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
You want to invest your money and time in opportunities. So we did a solid feasibility analysis. We won first place in the Small Business Institute best feasibility plan in the United States, and then we took it on for a whole nother semester. And after we determined it really was an opportunity, then we took it on to business plan and did their entire business plan. So opportunity to action is really the business plan. So we spent a year on it working with the client. They were very generous. They had a foundation. They gave the Collegiate Entrepreneurs Organization a donation, and for our students to get to go to national convention. And so they have a very successful microbrewer. And it's very cool, and it's not very far from the university, and they have put in sort of some barbecue pits, and they bring in jazz music from the university, and now they have one of our student teams in the same class that's working on an event center upstairs in the same original building. It's downstairs, so it's sort of the microbrewery and the bar, and then they're taking a couple of the houses, and they're going to put restaurants in that are sort of come to the window restaurants, so maybe burgers, and they're determining what that is with the feasibility analysis. So
that sounds like they're having fun. I'm just imagining though, turning a bunch of college students inside of a brewery could be a little dangerous as far as missing inventory or anything for the company.
Yeah, exactly. Well, when they were doing the plan, they didn't have any of the brewery equipment or any of that yet. It was just all in their heads. So
okay.
Actually, yeah. I was just there on Friday with one of my former students having a beer with him, and he was of age, thank God. So
Well, let's talk a little bit about family business succession. I know that a number of our listeners are founders, next gens that are considering transitioning the next 3 to 5 years. Research shows that only about 30% of privately owned businesses successfully transition to the second generation, and even less to the third and beyond. You've got a body of research on family business and family business succession. What advice do you have to next gen leaders to help their family business survive past the first generation?
Well, one is that training I talked about. Two, mm-hmm. I think you have to be very open-minded and look for the qualities you really want in that successor and who is interested. And sometimes, you know, it may be a, you know, might be a cousin or a daughter. It might, you know, be open-minded to who that is, gender-wise mm-hmm. as well as relative-wise. And sometimes it's not a family member. Maybe it's a non-family member. And it's very important to remember that to keep really good employees nowadays, you need to make sure they have opportunities also. So I've seen many times where maybe, you know, who the family thinks would be a good successor and is maybe somebody that wants to do it and they're in college still. But there's mm-hmm. a really great non-family member that has been in that company a long time that can carry it through to pass that on with some training. So mm-hmm. keep your eyes open is something. Don't be narrow-minded about it. And, you know, back in the day, you know, that it was males that were just successors, but times have changed and there's been very successful women successors. And so I think that's one issue. And really identify and put it on paper what the job description is. And, you know, what is it going to take for this person to meet those expectations? And do that early on. And I also think number five, I guess it would be, is have all your job descriptions out, have a yearly evaluation. So if there are family members that work in the business, that they get evaluated just like anybody else. And that's mm-hmm. an issue of fairness. And that's very, very important in family businesses because people automatically expect there to be preferential treatment to family members. And oftentimes there are. And when they see that, then there's bad feelings or in nowadays trying to get good employees is really hard. So they go off and find another job. So it's really important in terms of retention and recruitment to make sure that all the processes not only are fair, but there's a perception of fairness. Perception is 90% of everything is how people perceive what you're doing.
That's for sure. That's for sure. Well, I'm thinking back to those three circles you were talking about there earlier is, and transition we talk with our clients is there is a difference in ownership and leadership. And they don't have to be the same. So there's great non-family members either working in your business or maybe has someone outside of your business who has the skills that you really need to take your business to the next level. So having non-family member leaders is okay.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, everybody needs an opportunity and you got to keep that in mind. So, you know, realizing there's incentive systems, not just financial, but non-financial for family as well as non-family members is really important. And the perceptions are really important. I know when I worked for my mom and dad, everybody assumed I could do anything I want and could leave early and this and that. And actually my parents were much harder on me.
Yeah.
than they were on the regular employees. And then they, after a while, they realized that it wasn't, oh yeah, she's got it made, she can do anything she wants. That wasn't the case.
Sure. Well, so you've seen a lot of family businesses, ones that have succeeded in their business and entrepreneurism, and those that have failed. Is there an indicator of family business success that you've seen? For example, if you see a family business doing A, you are more confident that it will survive?
I think the number one thing is putting things down on paper. And, you know, it sounds simple, but one of the things I'd suggest is many universities across the country, not as many as we need, but do teach family business classes. Mm-hmm. And like in my class, I started out about 2000, oh, probably 16 years ago with about, you know, 10 students in the class. Now it's 60 every semester. And I don't have a seat in the class. So mm-hmm. it's popular. And we actually do 4 projects with students, one on history of the business. They actually do interviews and the business side, the family side, and then come up with a sort of a mini strategic plan.
Mm-hmm.
But I think writing down that history is very important. And if you do that, and you know, you can do some interviews with the founders and type it out, you know, if you have some pictures, that even helps. And then use that as part of the orientation for new employees in the family business, because really understanding the history makes them feel part of it.
Sure. Yeah, if you don't write it down, you don't have a plan, you just have an idea. So
And I understand, because I've had a couple small businesses myself, and some family businesses are very large. We have an assumption
sure.
all small, but they're not. Carlson Wagonlit Travel, that owns hotels and travel agencies and restaurants, is one example out of Minnesota. But there's some very large family businesses. And what we know from research is if we do studies on the stock market, the businesses that are family businesses, that the majority of the stock is owned by the family, are much more stable over time, are much more profitable than the non-family businesses. But, you know, so that's sort of publicly traded family businesses, but that's a whole nother area.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, that's
sure.
What we know is they're good places to work. They're usually more stable. They do more training. They last longer. They're not ones to maybe take a lot of high risk, though, you know, which is, if you're talking about people working somewhere, is a good thing. So we have to be careful that they always are innovative, and that's something that they always have to watch for.
Oh, well, thank great wisdom. And good thoughts and ideas today for our listeners. But and it's been fun. I could talk on all afternoon on this topic. But what are some closing thoughts you'd like to share with our listeners?
Well, I guess longevity counts. I just won the Lifetime Achievement Award from the U.S. Association for Small Business and Entrepreneurship, and I won the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Family Firm Institute.
Oh, wow.
And one thing, words of wisdom, is, you know, lasting matters. You know, I wouldn't have won the 2 awards if I hadn't been around for a while.
That's right.
But
that's right.
Lasting matters. Advertise it. You know, be proud of it. Hold it up as an example of stability and longevity and creativity and innovation. So that, you know, sometimes there's a perception if you're around a while, you're not creative and innovative, and that's just not true. You know, the things that make me the most excited are the things I create. So I think making sure your employees have a chance to be creative and innovative, and tie them into decision making in the company. is very important, and not just surface, like, feedback loops and all that stuff.
Yeah.
And do something. Just do something.
Just do something.
Well, I think that at some point we can talk about ideas and stuff, but carry it out into a feasibility plan. Take it from idea to opportunity. Is it really an opportunity? Not everything is. 60% of businesses that write a business plan fail. And they say, why could I, you told me to do a business plan. How could I fail when I did the business plan? I did everything I was supposed to. And I'm like, did you do a feasibility? Well, I didn't need to do that because it was my idea and I knew it was going to be right and it was going to work. Well, not all ideas are opportunities. So that's the thing is do the research, do the work, and I'm a big believer to write your own business plan. Either that or you have to be very involved with the person that's writing it with
sure.
you, because you're the one that's got to carry this thing out, and you have to know the financials. 95% of businesses fail because of cash flow. You've got to really get a full idea of that. And the other thing I always say is whatever you think it's going to cost, add a third. And that's been my experience in life. I mean, if you think about it, you go on a date, it always costs more than you think it does. If you go to buy a set of tires, it always costs more than you think it does. Or if the car breaks down, it always costs more than you think it does. So my experience over the, 40 plus years of doing this is, add a third, because that's going to be about right. Businesses are notorious to underestimate what things really cost, especially nowadays.
I was thinking about what you said about being loud and proud. One of the things that I have found in talking to family business leaders over the years is that some owners don't even want to promote or for people to even know that they're a family owned business. And I always share with them is celebrate being a family-owned business. People love doing business with family-owned companies. It shows dedication to a clear vision and to a certain family character and everything else. And so being a family business is a great thing to be, whether you're a first, second, third, or fourth beyond generation company.
That's absolutely true. Look at that Johnson Company with the wax and all those good
things. Yes,
that they hold that up. We're a family.
That's right.
Company. I think it's great. Murphy
it
Oil
is.
Soap out of Cleveland, Ohio was a family business for multi-generations that got bought out in the last 10 years or so, but it was Murphy's Oil Soap.
That's right. Murphy's Oil. Use it ourselves. Well, Dr. Welsh, thank you for being my guest on Family Business Today. Please accept our best wishes for a continued success for you, for your students, and for your book, Entrepreneurial Family Business, From Survival to Success.
And if you're interested in the book, I'd sure appreciate it. And it is available electronically. It's very reasonable. It's $23 for the electronic version and $46 for the soft-sided. And you can, if you Google or in your search engine, Entrepreneurial Family Business, Kendall Hunt Publishing, Kendall Hunt Publishing, it'll pull it right up and you can order it direct from there and they'll get it to you. And if you want the electronic version, it's just a day or so and it's there. And Greg is also going to pass that link on to you. Thank you, Greg.
You're quite welcome. And just to remind our listeners, to learn more about Dr. Welsh's new book, Entrepreneurial Family Business From Survival to Success, you can visit kendallhunt.com/products/entrepreneurial-family-business-survival-success. And we will have that in the podcast notes.
Thank you, Greg. It's been a pleasure.
Well, you're quite welcome. To our listeners, thank you for joining us for the Family Business Today podcast, brought to you by the Tennessee Center for Family Business, located in Nashville, Tennessee. Our passion is to help families create a positive environment where the family thrives, The business performs, and working together creates a lasting family legacy. Whether you're a business owner looking to grow your family business, or you're wanting to prepare to someday sell or transition the business to the next generation, check out our free resources on our website at www.pncfb.com. If you want to talk to a family business advisor about your specific family business needs, schedule a 30-minute, no-cost call by contacting us at info@tncfb.com. If you want to talk, we will listen. So until next time, thanks for joining us.